Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Well, every time you hear one of Bruce Springsteen's classic rock anthems, a private equity firm is running. It's running all the way to the bank. The same private equity firms that have taken over hotels on their last legs and aged care homes are pouring billions of dollars into buying up the music catalogues of artists like Bob Dylan and Justin Bieber and Stevie Nicks. The result is a blander music scene, says music journalist Mark Hogan. In an article for the New York Times, he explains how these companies are killing creativity by making new music less valuable than old hits. It's called Same Old Song. Private equity is destroying our music ecosystem. And journalist Mark Hogan joins me now. Hello.
Hi, Jesse. Thanks so much for having me.
Nice to have you on air in New Zealand. Is this something that's been happening in the music industry for a while?
Yes, yes and no. I mean, since before the pandemic, some of these institutional investors, including even like pension funds, have been looking at music copyrights as, you know, as an investment option. I guess basically streaming is what changed everything, because these investors started to see music as this kind of just, you know, reliable source of revenue where you could kind of track, you know, month by month and quarter by quarter what was going on mm-hmm. with the sales. So that was kind of the genesis of it. Was once streaming really took over, these institutional investors started looking at it. And then just basically as we were coming out of the pandemic and interest rates were so low, and you saw, you know, stuff like Bitcoin, you know, soaring to a high, which I realize is back there again, but the values of these song catalogs started soaring too. And you had people saying that it wasn't just like, you know, real estate or something like that with a reliable or, you know, or a bond with this kind of maybe, you know, reliable, you know, quarterly revenue, but that it actually was like oil or gold, and it was going to be this new amazing, you know, asset class. And we're talking about music here, which was, that was always kind of weird to me when I was first interviewing these guys, you know, 3 years ago. And then, yeah, now we've kind of seen the fruits of what's been happening, and it seems to be kind of, yeah, bland was a good word.
Yeah, I'm thinking about my guy Neil Young, but everyone will have favorites among this list. And should we be surprised that artists agree to sell?
No, I mean, yeah. Look, I'm definitely not trying to. You know, the article was sort of more for fans of music and explaining what's going on, and it wasn't saying that, you know, if you've got this great career and you're Neil Young or you're Bob Dylan. And to be fair, Bob Dylan's sale, I didn't see any clear sign of that. You know, there are no reports of private equity being involved in that one. But Dylan also sold his catalog for vast sums. You know, if you've had this great career, you've made these great songs, you should be able to make some money for it, of course. The problem is that just the incentives, I mean, it's sort of a symptom of just a broader problem in the industry where the money seems to be skewed toward what's already famous. And it's similar to what's happening in films where you're kind of, you know, oh, here's Super Mario Brothers, remember them? You know, now they have a movie. Oh, here's Barbie, which was a really good movie, but it's still just kind of, we're taking this IP, this intellectual property that's already existing and saying, hey, everybody, here's this thing you already know, let's repackage that. Or right now there's, you know, a new Indiana Jones film out. I mean, they've been making those movies for, what, over, you know, 40 years, and it seems like the new one is, you know, the review I read today was that it was pretty soulless, which kind of reminds me of some of the music that's been coming out of this trend as well.
I mean, there's another big trend in music, which is the loss of revenue and revenue streams for artists in the digital age. Is that connected to the thing you're writing about, private equity buying up
catalogs? I feel like when I had the chance to write, an op-ed for the New York Times, I definitely wanted to get all of this in there. The fact that people are, buying Bob Dylan's catalog or Bruce Springsteen's catalog is not directly taking money out of, some mid-level band's pocket or some, rising rapper or whatever it might be. But just, when you see these eye-popping numbers and then you see how little folks are being paid nowadays to make music. There was an article that I cited in my piece that was in Fast Company recently by the musician and former label owner Jenny Toomey, who was pointing out that you could sell a pretty reasonable number of CDs in the 90s and make like $50,000 or something. And then to do that nowadays, you need, I think it was like 1 million streams or some vast number of streams that is pretty tough for just an average artist to rack up. So just the way that the whole royalties regime is set up is it's skewed toward your megastars right now and people who already have hits. And then these new artists, there's more and more music being uploaded every day, and then you're competing with not only other current, not only current superstars, but you're competing with, this catalog. You're competing with, Pink Floyd or all these songs that have existed forever. And it's not just what people want to buy, like in the 90s or whatever. It's just what people choose to consume briefly, whatever's viral in the moment. So there is some legislation in the United States that I mentioned at the end of the piece that it seems like it's going to have an uphill battle to pass, but just trying to make things a little bit fairer for musicians, to make it, a little bit more possible for more musicians to eke out a living without being, superstars.
Yeah, I just did the maths, by the way. I've got 1 million streams gets you $5,000. Would that surprise you?
No, yeah. Whitney, thanks for doing the math. And and it is kind of complicated because they'll tell you if you contact Spotify, it's not like, every stream is at some exact rate. They have this kind of complicated formula and all of that. But yeah, it's just basically, yeah.
Are we part of the problem as listeners?
I'm not going to blame listeners because I don't think we're going to get anywhere doing that. I, like everybody else, I enjoy streaming music. I do buy records, but we all can't buy everything, right? When I was a big part of my musical education, I wouldn't be here today without Napster and, and file sharing. And my logic back then as a young person was, well, I'm going to all these shows that I wouldn't have gone to, and buying concert tickets and buying t-shirts that I wouldn't have bought because I was able to learn about all this music. And also I was buying the CDs back then too. Of course we always in everything, it seems like for consumers, convenience ends up trumping quality, and whatever's cheapest ends up trumping what helps out the people the people that we're paying. It's just, I think that we're kind of being short-sighted as a society, that we're in the situation now where it's, people are just kind of, this example didn't make it into the article, but are you familiar with what rickrolling is?
Yeah.
Is that a concept?
Yeah, I think everyone knows that.
Yeah, okay,
now.
Great,
yeah.
Great. Yeah. Well, so, there was an example, this was not in my piece, but a colleague of mine wrote about it for Pitchfork. One of these publishers is backed by private equity. The publisher contacted this rapper and because the publisher had a stake in Rick Astley's Never Gonna Give You Up, the song from the rickrolling meme, and basically suggested to this rapper, hey, sample this and build a song around it. And then the rapper did, and it was so kind of just lazy and derivative that Rick Astley actually sued, saying that they impersonated his voice on the hook because they didn't clear that part of it or anything. But and then the suit settled, so there's no wrongdoing. But just to me, that's like just the most extreme example of lazy, just kind of, here's this thing you already know, you don't even necessarily really like it, it's just a prank that you send to everybody and we're all familiar with. I guess my son probably actually really likes it, maybe the younger generation. But yeah, we've just kind of reached this point where there's more economic incentive to do that than to create something new. And of course, everybody always borrows from everybody, but that just seems really lame to me.
Yeah, very cynical. I'm speaking to music journalist Mark Hogan. He wrote an op-ed for the New York Times. It's called Same Old Song, Private Equity is Destroying Our Music Ecosystem. And then there's this song.
I wanna dance with somebody. I wanna be in a heat with somebody. Yeah.
So music is a business, has always been a business, Mark. What difference does it make when a private equity firm owns the rights to a song like I Want to Dance with Somebody?
Sure. I mean, I guess it's totally true. I mean, it is kind of a question of, you know, is this meet the same boss, you know, meet the new boss the same as the old boss? I guess the difference is that, you know, a record company, I mean, yes, there's plenty of songs, you know, about, you know, record companies being, you know, shady and all of that, but at least they have a long-term incentive in music. I mean, and hopefully there's some interest in music there. And then, you know, private equity, as you mentioned at the top of the show, I mean, they're just, it's just very famous for, you know, buying companies and then loading them with debt and then, you know, having them go bankrupt or whatever, or laying off workers. I mean, it's all about kind of the quick buck instead of the long-term view in general. I mean, I'm definitely generalizing here. So I think that would be one difference. But then I do think that it also just, it kind of, again, is just sort of another kind of indicator, like the fact that we've gotten to this point is just an indication of just kind of how denuded the ecosystem is for music, where, you know, you've got these tech companies too. You know, Spotify, I'm pretty sure they still haven't turned an annual profit. I mean, they're also sort of based on this whole kind of financialization of music, where it's like, you know, the share price, you know, hopefully, you know, they hope it goes up and they can sell the stock, but, you know, they're not making a profit, but they're also, you know, artists are complaining about these measly payouts. It's all just kind of becoming this shell game where, you know, again, it seems just very far removed from music. And of course, yes, like music and business have been opposed, you know, have been in a complicated relationship since the dawn of time. And I'm not trying to deny that. It's just, this seems, I think cynical was the word that you used earlier. And I thought that was a really good word. It just seems especially cynical right now. And I think that it'd be great if we could do some things to encourage some more creativity and a little bit less just cynicism.
That song I just played was bought in late 2022 as part of a $50 to $100 million deal by Primary Wave, a music publishing company backed by two private equity firms. And was that a good deal?
I mean, I guess it remains to be seen. But one thing I would say is that it does sort of seem like the this boom in these private equity backed publishers and private equity firms pouring money into song catalogs, it seems to have peaked for now. I mean, some of the private equity firms have been backing away. And, you know, one of the big players in this firm called Hypnosis, which is another sort of music publishing company, although there's some fancier name that they like to call themselves, like song management company or something like that, because of course we couldn't just be music publishers. They recently had to, you know, like devalue their, or they marked down the value of their catalog, and their CEO is no longer their CEO, although he's staying on as chairman. So it seems like this was one of those things that was to stray from music here and get back to boring financial talk. This seems like it was one of the things that was fueled by, you know, low interest rates a couple of years ago. Mm. And then now that in the States, you know, interest rates are higher, there's just not as much. Yeah, the these kinds of investments don't look quite as favorable next to boring old bonds and stuff for the financial wizards who seem to rule our world. So, I'm really glad, you know, that these artists got their payout. It's not trying to say that they don't deserve to make some money. It's just the money's going to old stuff, and and it'd be great to have some really creative new stuff too. Some people who are gonna, you know, I mean, how many albums did it take before Bruce Springsteen, you know, blew up? I mean, I think he got a few, and now it seems like there's not quite that much patience, obviously. And it's been going that way for years. I'm not trying to say things need to be the way they were in the olden days or something, but just saying I would like, right now and in the future, there to be, I think we should be talking about, you know, creating some more incentives for some more original art and less just cynical, bland, backwards looking nostalgia bait.
Yeah, what do you mean when you say that we are eating our artistic seed corn?
Well, Jesse, I live New York Times obviously is based in New York. I live in Iowa, which is kind of in flyover country in the United States. So there's a lot of, you know, farmland around here. So that maybe was what was on my brain. But, you know, it's the idea that there's this seed corn that they're going to, the farmers hopefully are going to plant in the next season. But, but things are so bad that we're having to eat that. And then we're not going to be able to plant the next year's crop. And who's gonna in 20 years be, I mean, maybe they will be. I really hope that the next generation is thinking way ahead of me, and that'd be great. But like, it just seems unlikely that somebody's gonna go back to that Rick Roll song that I mentioned and find some fresh inspiration from it. It's already just kind of, it just seems like we're just kind of constantly recycling the past. Or another song that I mentioned in the article was a Nicki Minaj song that basically just does the same thing that MC Hammer did, back in 1989, no shots at Hammer. He was like my hero at that in 1989, but like just to take, Rick James's Super Freak and a really, really catchy song and rap over it and then have a hit. And then all these years later, like Nicki Minaj takes Rick James's, Super Freak and raps over it and has a hit. It's like, Rick James was doing something that other people were moved to borrow from. And I think that it'd be great if people were doing more things that somebody 30 years from now might also be moved to borrow.
Yeah, I mean, is her song Super Freaky Girl, I think it's called, is mm-hmm. her song something that comes not from musical inspiration but from a boardroom plan, and is that the problem?
Right, yeah, I mean, that was another one that was the publisher, I believe that was Primary Wave, who are backed by private equity, and they had kind of maneuvered it, they had a share of Rick James's catalog. And again, it was one of those kinds of things where they bought it from, it wasn't from Rick James himself. I believe it was from one of the other songwriters. They were just like, well, how can we, maximize the value from this asset that we own? And, all these ways of talking about music that, I mean, again, maybe I'm not trying to sound like naive and idealistic. I realize that, that people make money off of this stuff, but it just feels really antithetical to why most of us love music and how most of us think about music and how I think creative people think about creating.
I think, and I think we've covered some of the issues with the repurposing those old catalogs, but can you just draw the line for us? Why does that affect the creation of new music?
If we're just kind of constantly surrounded by old stuff all the time that we've already heard a million times, and people can disagree with this, that's totally fine, but it just feels to me like, if we're in this world where, maybe we're going to have, I think in the column I mentioned, what if there was a, Dark Side of the Moon theme park or whatever, just that it just all feels like oxygen that is being taken away from new music. It's just the same thing as when you're on your radio dial, and if all you're hearing is the same stuff, then there's no exposure being given, no oxygen being given. I'm really mixing my metaphors here with the sweet corn and oxygen, but it just really feels like if we're paying only attention to, Bob Marley was great, now let's put out a Bob Marley biopic. And Bob Marley was great, but like part of that is that Primary Wave, owns a stake in his catalog, and so that's another way to boost this stuff. And if we just constantly are looking backward, then it just feels like, there's only so much time and space, on the radio and in the press and on the streaming platforms.
And in our ears.
And it's hard enough to keep up with new music, as everybody knows. So it just would be great. It feels like now there's this big money, and it's big money for the music industry. It's not big for the private equity firms. I mean, they've got tons of it, but there's this big money for the music industry that's backing the old stuff, and that just my argument is that's kind of pushing attention away from newer stuff that could also be worthy and could also become celebrated and be catalog and be classic in time.
Yeah, you wrote quite beautifully, we need to make the making of music important enough again for that future John Lennon to pick up a guitar. So how do we do that? Just a simple question to end with.
I think efforts like, like the bill that was introduced recently, in Congress, in the U.S. Congress, to try to increase artist streaming payouts would be one step. I mean, one thing that I believe New Zealand does well is, and this is never going to happen in the States in anytime soon, is, a lot of governments fund the arts and fund music. I mean, this well, I'm sure, but I think that's something that if you look at countries around the world, which I've done for previous articles, a lot of countries, K-pop didn't happen in a vacuum. South Korea is heavily funding music, and there's lots of great music coming out of there. New Zealand has had lots of great music, and you know, Australia, of course. I mean, and there's great funding for music in those places. It's not the case in the States. I mean, we barely give people healthcare here, so we've got kind of an uphill battle on that road. But yeah, I mean, I think that just taking some steps to get artists actually paid, and I think for just listeners, I mean, like, you know, going to shows and, you know, buying T-shirts and buying records and supporting artists directly. I mean, that's, you know, I think it's getting harder and harder for artists to make money even on the road nowadays, at least in the States. But yeah, just doing what we can as fans to actually, you know, show our support to artists, it really helps them.
As a music journalist, you got any favorites out of New Zealand?
Yes, I mean, I'm kind of, you know, an indie rock nerd originally, coming from, I used to write for Pitchfork, so a huge fan of the Flying Nun bands out of Dunedin, you know, the Clean, bands like that, you know, the Chills. Written about a number of bands from New Zealand over the years. I mean, Shocking Pinks was one.
Wow, great. Them, but, yeah, good reference.
Yeah. Saw the Ruby Suns once. I think they're from New Zealand. You know, yeah. I wrote some stuff a while. Well, anyway, yeah. No, I think that's probably enough for me rambling about New Zealand bands. But I did I mean, I there's one article a few years back where I spent a lot of time talking to folks in Wellington about a band from there that there were some allegations against. And so, yeah, just really nice people in the scenes down there that I really enjoyed getting to know everybody, even if it was for a bad reason in that story. But big fan.
I mean, we haven't really talked about music journalism, but that must be feeling in some sort of similar danger at the moment. That news that Pitchfork's being rolled into GQ, I don't think that was received particularly well for the people who have been there since day one.
Yeah, no, thanks. Yeah, thanks for thinking of that, Jesse. I mean, and that probably informs my gloomy outlook a little bit. Is yeah. I mean, we, you know, a dozen of us were laid off, and that was a month after we were told that we weren't going to be laid off. So I mean, and I'm doing fine. And obviously, I was quite lucky to be writing about music for so many years as it was, and I'm hopefully still going to keep writing about music, and I'm happy to be talking about music. But yeah, it's definitely a dire time in the media in general right now, or at least it feels that way in the States. So hopefully that improves too. But yeah, right now it's I'm kind of looking at things kind of a glass half empty perspective at the moment, but I do think that you know, hopefully things will improve.
If you're looking for something to do after the show today, listeners, you can read up Mark's review of Ed Sheeran's most recent album. Mark gave it 3.8 out of 10. Opening line: Ed Sheeran has bragged that he wrote 7 of his new album songs in 2.5 hours. It's easy to believe him.
Jesse, now they're all going to be glad that I'm laid off. What are you doing to me? What are you doing? No. Yes, yeah. I've definitely written lots of silly and snarky things over the years. So yeah, I've been very, very fortunate. But I just didn't like the album. What can I say?
Okay. Nice to talk to you. Thank you for all the thought and care that you've put into this story. People can read it on the New York Times website. Same old song: private equity is destroying our music ecosystem. And great to spend some time chatting to you today.
Really glad to be here, Jesse. Thank you so much.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.